Hi, you're back on Voices from the Front Lines, the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour with KPFK 90.7. This is Eric Mann with my co-host Damon Azali, and we're on the phone with Ed Avall, professor at USC Keck School of Medicine. Ed, do we have you?
Yes, how are you doing?
Good. Can you speak up a little bit?
Sure, how's that?
That's much better. Congratulations on the study. I don't know if you know about our work, but that's not the main point. But Damon and I work at the Labor Community Strategy Center and also work with a group called the Bus Riders Union. And I wrote a book called LA's Lethal Air in 1990-91, in which we studied a lot of the studies. So your study is called The Effect of Air Pollution on Lung Development from 10 to 18 Years of Age, just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine September 9th, 2004. You're one of the co-authors and organizers of it. One person's name I recognize is David Bates. He's up in Vancouver, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so he's been in the trenches for many, many years. We'll come back to that. In my book, LA's Lethal Air, we used a lot of the work of Russell Sherwin, who I'm sure you know, who did the work on the actual autopsies of kids who died in gang violence in the 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, and found tremendous lung lesions and a level of lung damage with children, you know, young adults, that was beyond comprehension because of LA's Lethal Air. What is the specific contribution to this ongoing debate, unfortunately, that your study indicates? Would you summarize the key conclusions of your study, and we'll get later to the implications for public policy?
Okay, well, what we did was follow the health, the respiratory health, as children grew from age 10 through 18 years of age across a dozen communities in Southern California, about 1,800 children, students at schools throughout the communities, and every year measured their lung function and tracked their growth to understand why and how their lungs were growing, and also measured the air quality in their respective communities throughout all this time, so continuously for 8 years. And at the end of that 8 years, we looked at all the data to look and see how these children had grown. And what we found were that the children in the cleaner communities had faster growing lungs than the children in the more polluted communities, but moreover, that at the end of these 8 years of follow-up, for the 18-year-olds, about five times as many kids that lived in the higher pollution communities had significant decrements in lung function, significant defined as what would be clinically significant if you went to the doctor's office and came in for a physical and had a measurement made. And this, after adjusting for the air pollution and adjusting for all the other variables, was assignable to the fact that they had been breathing dirtier air and growing up in more polluted air.
So, Ed, when you talk about the cleaner versus not as clean communities, do those fall in terms of racial lines, like as South LA?
No, not necessarily. Our communities actually... study communities were chosen on the basis of historical air pollution profiles to be high and low in differing pollutants so that we could tease out the more subtle effects of specific pollutants. And our communities range from communities up in the San Luis Obispo County area all the way down through Los Angeles, out east to San Bernardino and Riverside, and down to San Diego. Unfortunately, we did not have any communities in the study in south Los Angeles. Our communities were more on the eastern edge of Los Angeles and then south of the metropolitan area.
So, Ed, what are the actual effects? I know a lot of the stuff in the report was about forced air pressure with children breathing. What are the actual effects in terms of disease, in terms of asthma, that this talks about?
Well, this particular article reported on lung function per se, that is the ability to take in and move out air as measured by flows and volumes. We also have done other studies that have also shown increases in symptoms and asthma, actually, in children, not only just the increase in aggravation of existing asthma, but actual causal effects of asthma, of pollution effects, that is, of ozone, particularly, with respect to children's health. And so we have some good information from these several years of study on several thousand children that pretty clearly show effects both on symptoms effects on respiratory disease in the way of asthma and bronchitis, and effects on actual respiratory lung growth in the way of lung function measurements of spirometry, which are measurements of flows and volumes.
Well, looking at that, I mean, let's, on a factual level, what was the severity of the deprivation in terms of lung flow? How bad was it in terms of the change?
Well, across the 8 years, the criteria typically clinically of being of significance is a benchmark is sort of set at 80% of predicted. And there's obviously a range among a population, but if you look at the group that we studied, it was a threshold set at 80% of what would be predicted for your height, weight, ethnicity, age, et cetera. Five times as many kids in the pollution, in the polluted areas, almost 9% of the kids had this functional effect less than 80% of the decrement compared to those in the cleaner communities where only about 1.5 to 2% of them had a significant decrement.
Well, one of the dilemmas that we're finding is that we've been organizing, we at the Strategy Center have been organizing for almost 15 years in Los Angeles around the kind of studies that you've done, that is to say, which is excellent, important studies. I remember being at the Air Quality Management District arguing based on studies before yours that given this data, which is undisputable in my opinion, we need radical control of, for instance, right now the Strategy Center is calling for a 50% reduction in the autos in Los Angeles from 8 million in Los Angeles County to 4 million and a 100% increase in the air CAFE standards, that is to say, instead of 25 miles a gallon, trying to get 50 miles a gallon, and also trying to get double the bus fleet. Now, that all sounds good. I mean, you as a scientist, I assume, would be in general agreement with that policy, those kind of policy recommendations. Although, let me just ask that. Are you? Do you think that, where do you see the public policy implications for the science that you've just generated?
Well, the science pretty clearly shows, I mean, there's sort of a good news story in here in the sense that the science clearly shows that if you clean up the air, if you reduce emissions and reduce pollution, you can actually have a measurable effect on the lung function, growth, and development and health of these children. And so cleaning up the air, accomplishing that by any means, by reducing emissions from tailpipe, for example, by getting more efficient vehicles so that you have less pollution in terms of more miles effectively driven for a given gallon of gas, more effectively moving people around, and thus using less gasoline and so forth, all those things contribute to cleaner air. In that sense, it clearly will have an effect on children's health.
Well, one of the dilemmas we found is that, and that's where I remember David Bates and Russell Sherwin and others, is that this data would be given to the Air Quality Management District, and then people from the Harvard Business School would show up and say, you have more chance of dying in an in an air crash, or you have more chance of dying if you drink too much, and that basically this data is interesting, but the auto is here to stay. They would dispute your science. They would say that, you know, everybody has to live with something. They sounded very much like the cigarette lobby at the time. And the AQMD capitulated to them, interestingly, and actually started this crazy plan to buy and sell air pollution under a market-driven plan. So I realize that you're a scientist, not necessarily an organizer or an activist, but what are the dilemmas when study after study, I mean, you've worked, I assume, since it was, how long was this, an 8-year study?
It actually was a 10-year study, started in 1992.
And were you involved in it since 92?
Yeah, I was part of the designers, and I was the assistant director of the study.
Okay, great. So you invested 1992 to 2004, a lot of your life, to try to do an objective assessment of the situation. How do you feel when you see all these SUVs, when you see the ad campaigns for crazy consumption of autos and stuff like that? How do you feel as a scientist when your data clearly indicates that the kids are in trouble, but the society and the auto manufacturers disregard your own work?
Well, I think I think it's pretty clear that something needs to be done. In our particular case, actually, this study could not have been done without the support and help of the Air Quality Management District, because they provided a lot of the air monitoring information that helped us to collect the kind of data we need to be able to look at the health and match that to the air pollution out there. But nevertheless, in terms of inefficient vehicle mileage and CAFE standards and so forth, it's pretty clear that the society is often out of touch with what the information is out there available says. And this study itself, it ought to be a pretty striking example. And in fact, it's gotten a lot of coverage from a lot of people, and there have been editorials in the paper and so forth to do something on the basis of this, now clearer than ever. So, I myself right now, I'm speaking to you from the driver's seat of a Prius, so the case for getting the SUVs off the road is not a tough one for me to make.
And the Prius is a car that actually next year won't be getting the rebates for the hybrid cars, right?
I don't know what the status is of the rebates, but my point, I guess, is that it's a smaller engine and a hybrid vehicle that gets better mileage.
Well, it was interesting because I was reading in the LA Times yesterday in the editorial section that basically, Congress is going to phase out the tax deduction given to hybrid cars to zero next year, and I guess from 2000. But at the same time, for SUVs, they're giving up to $100,000 tax rebates for.
Well, I think that's that obviously, for my part, is very short-sighted given what we know about emissions, car exhaust, and human health. And I guess it's incumbent upon all of us to do what we can to help direct public health policy and for the health and welfare of our citizens by taking this sort of information and taking it to our regulators and, just putting it out there in front of them and explaining to them and reiterating and demanding that they do something in terms of public health.
Well, thanks so much. The report is very good, and even though some of the specifics are a little hard to do, the good thing, if people want to get a copy of the report, is that the abstract is really good, the opening and conclusions are really good, and you'll have a little trouble grappling with the specific science, but it's very accessible. How can people get it? I guess they have to go to the New England Journal of Medicine, right?
Well, they actually can get on the State Air Resources Board, who was the primary funder of the study. If they go to arb.ca.gov and click on Children's Health Study, they'll get summary information about all of these related studies.
Ed, thank you so much, and thanks for the tremendous work you've done for the last 12 years.
Well, thank you, and good luck.
Okay.
We'd like to thank our guests besides Ed, Ted Glick, Art Torres. Today we have music with Black Star, Bob Dylan, Karen Casey, and Public Enemy. Please let us know what you think of our show, 213-387-2800. And we'd also like to thank Alan Minsky and Maggie LaPique. We'll see you next week.
Hang in there.